Whether you drive a car,
need a car,
or just occasionally bum a ride with friends,
you've come to the right place.
Join Jill and Tom as they break down everything that's going on in the auto world.
New car reviews,
shopping tips,
driving green,
electric cars,
classic cars,
and plenty of great guests.
This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
All right, this is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I am Tom Appel. Thank you for joining us today. When you get a chance, do me a big favor. Check us out at consumerguide.com. You know the drill. If you're looking for a new car or truck, check out our reviews. If you're just looking to be entertained, go ahead and check us out there too. And you can listen to back episodes of the podcast right there on our homepage, though you should subscribe. All right, in studio with me is Brendan Appel of the Sons of Speed, sitting in for Jill, who's getting a pedicure. How are you, sir?
I'm great. My pedicure was earlier today. So
you're good?
I'm good.
Yeah, that's why you're wearing sandals.
That's right.
And little tissues between your toes.
Yeah, they're free. You know, they give them to you for free there. You forget to bring yours.
How are you, man?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a while. Jill's been in studio a lot.
Yeah, she's been hogging the mic, you know. So
she has.
But glad to be here. Happy to be here always. And good to see you. And it's been a really nice summer.
It has.
The weather's just been so nice. And we're still kind of in summer here, and even though it's October.
It's weird because it seemed like the extreme heat just disappeared one day and it was nice. And we kind of, I don't know if everyone realizes that it's actually warm for the season right now.
Yeah, we're kind of getting spoiled right now.
We are, and that's about to fall off a cliff. I think temperatures dropped like 20 degrees in Chicago. Chicago area later this week.
Well, as a avid golfer, I don't applaud that change, and I'm actively, like, my entire Facebook feed right now is telling people who want fall to arrive to be quiet because summer is better.
I was actually just complaining today. Nick DiGilio, whose show I do fairly frequently, he's got a podcast, the Nick D podcast, which is excellent. But he was complaining that it isn't cool and crisp enough right now. Like, we don't get enough autumn, and that autumn is by far the best season in Chicago.
Okay, well, two things can be true at the same time.
That's true. Get
enough autumn.
That's true.
And summer is the best season.
My argument about Chicago, and it's getting worse, it seems, not better, is that we don't have enough windows open days.
Yeah, that's true.
It's always, like, just a little too humid.
Right.
Like, you get in bed, and you're like, it's kind of sticky. Honey, yeah. flip on the air.
Or you're like my daughter, who just came back to school, home from living in Texas for 4 years, and cranks the AC to like 62, and I'm freezing my tail off. We feel like we're living in an igloo now in our own house, and the bills come in. Yeah, I'm like, apparently everybody in Texas loves their air conditioning to the max. So
they live in Texas, but they love their air conditioning.
I know. It's like, it's weird. They're raging against the climate. That they lived in.
Oh, man. Real quick, remind us about the Sons of Speed.
Yeah. So we are a automotive outlet that focuses primarily on how cars drive, how they make you feel, kind of eking out the performance from anything that we can get our hands on. And you can find everything we do at wearemotordriven.com, because we are part of the Motor Driven conglomerate that includes Auto Exotica, Rides and Drives, and The Median, which are run by a group of people and friends of ours and yours. And so check us out. wearemotordriven.com and We Are Motor Driven on Facebook as well. Facebook and YouTube is where I went.
And there is now the We Are Motor Driven podcast.
Correct.
Which is very good.
Yes.
It's very good.
So just search We Are Motor Driven wherever you get your podcasts. And all of our stuff, we like to say, is relatively timeless. So it doesn't matter when it comes out, because we're just really podcast topic oriented. It's all car topics. And it's a great thing to listen to when you're on a road trip.
as a media creator, and you guys know this, that when you're creating stuff that's going to go up online and be there forever or for a long time, you worry about whether or not you want to be timely or have something that's going to be searched in 18 months.
Correct.
And it's really tough to do that. And there are some excellent outlets. The Drive.
Yes.
For example, which is an excellent automotive outlet. They're really on top of the news.
They are.
And it's tough to compete with that. So I often write things that are either long-term newsy, way in advance, or just classic car stuff that should be evergreen.
Exactly. You do a great mix of both of those.
The Drive is
definitely a great news outlet. So if you want to see what's going on today, that's a great email to get every day. We kind of take the opposite extreme, where we're just talking about stuff that's timeless, you know, kind of like best car chase movie scenes and cars and things like that.
Yeah.
it's just good debate topic material, and we have a great time with the four of us debating. So
yeah, good stuff, and your podcast is excellent.
Thank you very much.
So interesting automotive news. There is a rumor going around, and Jill and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and I thought this was what was going to happen, but it looks like the Wagoneer, the Jeep Wagoneer, is going to go away.
Really?
But the Grand Wagoneer is going to stick around. So.
Okay.
Those vehicles are relatively new. And for people who don't know about them, they're large SUVs. They compete with the likes of the Tahoe, the Suburban, the Navigator,
This would be the equivalent of the Tahoe going away, but the Escalade sticking around.
Kind of. That's kind of what that is. And it looks like Jeep may have overreached a little bit when they brought out both the Wagoneer and the Grand Wagoneer, because they had a pretty broad price range, though the Wagoneer was fairly expensive. When they were a little ambitious with their pricing when it came out. And so it looks like, and there's news coming down tomorrow, though it may be embargoed, that we're just going to see an expanded Grand Wagoneer range with new, more affordable models, and the Wagoneer will go away. And if you're a dealership, you're probably happy about this.
Yes, because trying to explain this difference to customers has probably been a headache for them.
It is. And if you've ever passed a Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram dealer, you see that they don't have enough space for all their cars.
Right.
And it's mostly filled up with Wranglers and Ram 1500s.
The one by my house is next to a Costco, which has had an empty lot somewhere on the general premises. It wasn't their property. They acquired that just to put a whole bunch of cars that they couldn't fit on their lot, to your point. And you're right. I think that the dealers are going to like it. I think customers will, in their mind, they're thinking Grand Wagoneer when they're talking about Wagoneer.
Probably.
Even if it isn't, so might as well just, like you said, bring some of the affordability into Grand Wagoneer. You don't need Wagoneer at that point.
Nope, just a kind of entry-level base Grand Wagoneer will do it.
You know, and it probably doesn't help that Stellantis keeps having to recall the Wagoneer.
No, that does not help.
123,000 Wagoneer recalls like about 10 days ago. So
not good.
No.
So I've got some numbers here. Grand Wagoneer for the third quarter, 31,000. I'm sorry, Wagoneer and Grand Wagoneer.
Okay, so they lump them to sales together anyway.
Yeah, 35,000. Tahoe and Suburban, 91,000. Expedition and Navigator, what is that, 59,000? Mm-hmm. The Yukon, they call it Yukon XL, 67,000.
Yeah, that's a sell surprisingly well.
Yeah, that's a moneymaker.
And you know, that's not a fleet vehicle. You can't go rent one of those. You can rent the Tahoe. You can even rent the Grand Wagoneer. I think Enterprise has the Wagoneer, Grand Wagoneer in their rental lineup. You may be able to rent. I know you can rent the Expedition because I rented one, and I forget which company does that, but I have never seen any of the GMC stuff in rental fleets, so that's a more impressive.
Yeah, they protect
number.
The resale value of that vehicle.
Oh, yeah.
And the Yukon and the Tahoe used to be pretty similar. Mm-hmm. That's not the case anymore. The interiors are different. They are definitely, Yukons are definitely upscale.
I like that. I just, the whole thing feels very much more like a Jeep Wagoneer, ironically. It's just a little more an outdoorsy brand. Even the name Yukon just conjures up that image. Yeah. And they do, you know, the professional grade label that they put on GMC.
Which I think is good marketing.
It's great marketing.
Yeah. Professional grade works. It's like you're the boss.
Exactly.
At a construction site kind of thing.
Exactly. And they play that up very well, and it works very well.
Yeah. Escalade, 36,000. That's a ton of profit.
That is when you think about they're like up there, they got to be up there on Escalades with Porsche profit pricing.
I think they are.
Yeah.
I think they are, yeah.
If any of those are IQs, they're insanely profitable.
Yeah, because they'll start, what, 140 now?
Yeah.
Armada, Nissan Armada and Infiniti QX80, those are essentially the same thing. That is combined for 22,000. Interestingly, the QX80 very close to the Armada in sales. So they're both kind of premium. I don't think the price difference is big enough.
Right.
Why not go Infiniti? Get the better warranty, get the luxury brand.
And probably free loaners and some breakfast at certain places.
There you go. And then finally, the Sequoia with its very loyal Toyota.
Yes.
Almost 20,000 units so far.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And that big market for those big SUVs is something that's very American. You will not find that in a lot of other places. It's just interesting to hear the sales.
And numbers. Despite all the competition, they still command the big dollars.
Yes, they do.
They still get this money.
Yeah, you wonder why. Okay, so like 20,000 units, not that much. You talked about, I think, last week, all of the sedans. And what was it? I think the 7 Series sold nearly 20,000. You wonder, okay, well, why does it stick around? Because the profit margin is huge.
It's huge. And it's those vehicles are completely amortized because they still sell well in Europe.
Yes.
So it isn't a big effort for them to sell them here. And all of those big sedans are imported.
They have to sell them well in places like Russia, I got to think, because...
The Middle East, Russia.
Yeah,
markets like that.
Big, yeah, and it's the preferred... A VIP vehicle, let's just say. Some of those, like the Escalades and the Navigators.
It is. Do you remember the movie Coming to America?
Yeah, I love the movie Coming to America.
When James Earl Jones comes to America and he's going to the Waldorf Astoria, and he's just, there's a chain of black Mercedes S-Classes.
Yes. That used to be it. That used to be like the, you know, the ambassador's vehicle, really.
And they had flags on the front fenders.
I remember.
That just looks so badass.
You were, that's an arrival.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yes. And then if the guy getting out of the car is James Earl Jones, like, that's really an arrival.
Yeah.
I am king.
He is.
I love that dude.
He's also Darth Vader.
Yes. So, yeah, that's quite a resume.
Yeah. Lord, king, you know, he's got the whole royalty thing going.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good resume.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, I would get a job if I had those on mine.
Exactly.
So last month, EV madness. As people, people rushed.
What happened to the cliff? I actually came here with the express intention of learning everything you know about what happened on October 1st, because I unfortunately didn't get a chance to catch up on it. Did prices stay the same? Did they drop? What happened?
I get the sense that nothing has happened yet.
Okay.
And I think everyone's taking a deep breath, and things will happen. But the biggest story, and my favorite story, is that Ford and General Motors found the greatest workaround. And you're an attorney. You'll love this.
I will.
They figured out that if they were to put down payments down on vehicles, essentially buying them for their lease divisions, I think.
Okay.
They own those vehicles and can claim the incentives. So it sounds like Ford and General Motors have essentially leased to themselves every leftover outstanding 2025 EV.
Prior to the expiration.
Wow, so they are getting, General Motors is getting the $7,500 bucks, which they intend to hand out to the customers.
Very nice.
That's a good scam.
It is a very, that's actually good lawyering. Somebody thought that through real well, read the fine print and acted upon it. The one thing that keeps going through my mind is, do you remember when the Ford Lightning finally qualified for the EV tax credit?
Yeah.
And what did Ford do immediately upon that news?
Raise the price.
Exactly the amount of the rebate. So it seems to me if you could do that, you could do it in reverse, and maybe these prices will come down by the level of, or at least approximately the level of the prior rebate. And if that happens, I think it's a win for consumers and ironically taxpayers if that happens.
Hyundai did lower the price of the Ioniq 5 already.
Yes, they did.
So that's an example of what can happen. And since the incentives went into place, I think we can assume that manufacturers have gotten better at building these things, and they can build them more efficiently and at lower cost.
Right. And so I want listeners not to forget that your state may offer an EV incentive. I know Illinois does. I don't know if California still does. But Illinois is like it kind of comes and goes. It's like the waning waxing moon.
Yeah, and I think it's
coming soon.
It's a question of funding, but it's up to $2,000 often.
No, four.
$4,000?
Yeah, in Illinois.
From Illinois? Wow.
However, they prioritize that by income, which so what that means is the people who can afford it may not get and first in line to get it. So I'm not sure how that plays out logistically or logically even, but it's still there. So there are potentially some other incentives, even if the federal credit isn't there.
It's funny, too, when the incentives originally kicked in, there was a lot of outcry about how this was just a tax incentive for rich people.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, there was no other way this was going to happen. Manufacturers are not going to start losing money on small cars right away.
Yes.
When they can build bigger cars and bury the cost of the EV in the cost of the vehicle. So that was just the way that was going to play out at first. And ultimately, we did see far more affordable vehicles. And I mean, Chevy did come up with the Equinox EV. The new Nissan Leaf starts at 30 grand. There's a lot of good news here for EV buyers.
Yep.
And hopefully we can get through this rough patch without incentives.
Yeah.
Because they're not coming back in the next 3 years.
No. And it will, what it will do is will force the manufacturers to streamline as much as possible their costs. And some of that, unfortunately for us, is in the industry, may come out of the marketing budget, as it seems to always be the first victim.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it results in better vehicles at cheaper prices to consumers and they can streamline things and make them better, that's all the more better for it. I keep thinking back to the boat that I missed when they first launched the EV. Do you remember this? The EV tax credit is that it somehow, because of the wording of it, applied to electric golf carts. And people were getting free electric golf carts for $7,500.
I don't remember this at all.
And somehow I missed the memo and I don't have my free golf cart. Oh. Not that I needed one, but hey, if you're handing them out for free.
I love a good loophole, and I don't remember that
one. Yeah, they closed that one pretty quickly. It only lasted maybe a year, maybe two.
So speaking of EVs, you guys recently drove and then did a video about the Cadillac Optiq.
Yeah, is it Optiq or Optique? I kind of like the Optiq.
I don't know. I want to say that. I like the Optiq.
Doesn't it sound a little more French?
Celestique.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got a little more panache to it.
And Cadillac French? Anyway.
Yeah, he probably was.
I think he was, yeah.
Like Chevrolet?
Yep. Louis.
So, yes, we did drive that vehicle. Our review is up on our YouTube channel. Again, We Are Motor Driven. You can find that YouTube channel. You'll find that as probably the most recent video. And I got to say, it was an interesting drive. As Sons of Speed, we focus on the drive, not necessarily all the bells and the whistles and the screens and things like that, which were all very nice. It felt a little less Cadillac to me, having grown up with Cadillac. You know, I've owned Cadillacs in the past. My parents owned a Cadillac, so I've kind of used to like the over-opulence of some of those models. This one was more, it kind of felt more like a nice Hyundai or a Genesis vehicle, in that it was using sustainable materials. There wasn't a lot of leather in there. Mm-hmm. The Corinthian leather wasn't in the vehicle. But
we snuck in a Cordoba reference.
I did.
I think that's like 10 episodes.
I'm really
in
good
a row
at that. Right. Randy's not looking too heavy about it. But the thing that got me about this vehicle, I don't know what it was, but the steering was just weird. It had this weird, almost like a torque steer stick to it. It wasn't like it was a normal torque steer. So if you don't know what torque steer is, if you have a front-wheel drive car that has a lot of power and not balanced half shafts, you step on the gas, especially when you're turning, but even when you're not, the car wants to pull one way or the other.
Yeah, and it can be especially pronounced with a turbocharged engine.
Yes, and if you ever get a chance to drive a front-wheel drive Turbo Talon or GSX or Laser, boy, did those things have torque steer. Anyway, it wasn't yanking the wheel, but it wasn't returning to center on its own.
Oh,
that's
not good.
It was just kind of like holding in weird places. It was very odd. It was the only thing.
Was that a drive mode thing?
We tried in different drive modes, and it seemed to stick around for all of them. So I don't know if some of these vehicles we get are pre-production. All I'm saying is that if you're going to look at this vehicle, test drive it.
Uh-huh.
Make sure you test drive it. Test drive it in different modes. And just, you know, maybe this was a fluke of this particular vehicle and not the whole lineup. I haven't really heard much said about that elsewhere, but that particular vehicle had some steering weirdness going on.
It's funny. I was just talking about what makes a car sporty with Nick DiGilio, and one of the things I talked about was steering feel.
Yes.
And how steering feel, no matter what, is largely artificial now because all steering is electric.
Yeah.
There's no hydraulic system anymore. And that's for a bunch of reasons, including ADAS systems.
Yep.
And
autonomous driving and help.
And electric cars.
Yes.
Where you wouldn't have a hydraulic pump. And it's a shame about that. And it'll be interesting to know because there's a V version, a high-performance version of this car.
Oh.
It'd be good to know if that feels better.
I would love to drive that and figure it out because we were looking for a V button because sometimes even though you're not in a V vehicle, it'll have a V button on it, and the V button will sort of just perk it up and give it a little more goose. This thing did not have a lot of power, but otherwise, it handled really well. It kind of had that nice sport-tuned suspension you get typically in an Audi or BMW. So it handled twisty roads well, but for that steering issue that might be an anomaly. I would cross-shop this thing with a Genesis GV60, for example.
Okay.
Something along that line, which is approximately the same price. It was mid-50s to start with, about high-50s to finish with.
Cadillac's got 5 electric vehicles right now. So,
which is a lot.
Which I think is the most of any retailer in the United States. And I think to a large extent what they're trying to do with these vehicles is really replicate the gas vehicle experience.
100%.
I don't think that they're stepping out further. Now, I just drove the Volvo EX30, and that's kind of a new age vehicle. That felt new, and it felt electric, and it was wonderful.
I was going to say, I have a feeling you liked that vehicle.
I love that vehicle, like crazy. And that had light steering, but it was good and progressive steering.
And we drove the EX90, which is the very big brother to the 30, and loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, and I had an XC90, which is the gas version, and this thing was nothing like that vehicle. I mean, it might have looked the same from the outside, similar. It was such a good vehicle, I couldn't believe it.
Given how good Volvo's electric vehicles seem to be, I think that Polestar, though they've had a very rough launch,
yes,
has a bright future.
Yeah.
And I'll be driving the Polestar 3 soon, so I'm looking forward to
let's
that.
Let's plug last week's episode where you have a nice discussion with Polestar on that.
Yeah, the Polestar folks, and they seem to be ready to go now. And they got, you know, they got kicked in the butt by tariffs and having to move production, so the EX30 is not coming in as affordably as it could have.
Right.
Which is a bummer, but it's still, I think, at 46 grand, 48 grand, a good deal.
Yeah, we drove the Polestar 3 at the rally back in May and really enjoyed it. In fact, we drove it back-to-back with the Volvo EX90 and a lot of the same switchgear is in there. But it felt like a very sporty version of the EX90, which we already loved the dynamics on that vehicle, and it just got better when it got into the Polestar.
Yeah. All right, so you've got the Optic video up. How can people watch that?
Yeah, go to YouTube, search We Are Motor Driven, and just pull up the list of videos. It should be right there on top.
I need to watch that. I think I did watch that.
Yeah.
It's been up for a little bit?
A little bit, a couple weeks.
Yeah, I think I've seen that. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we talk to Rob Newton, Senior Director of Marketing at ChargePoint, the Level 3 charging people.
Yes, the very important part of this whole EV project.
And given things I have said about ChargePoint, it's really good of them to join us.
Yes, indeed.
All right, let's take a break. We'll be right back.
Questions or comments?
Drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.
That's carstuff@consumerguide.com. Welcome back to the Car Stuff Podcast.
And we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I'm Tom. He is Brendan Appel, sitting in for Jill Simonello this week. How are you doing, sir?
Good. I almost called her Jesus.
I did. I was actually going to say the word Jesus. You caught that. Which is really weird. If I had a long list of Jesus-like people, I don't know if Jill would be on it.
We love you, Jill.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just a gender thing.
No.
All right. We're going to talk a little charging now.
Excellent.
EV charging. We just talked about EVs. Now we're going to talk about EV charging. The four biggest networks right now in the U.S. are Tesla, Electrify America, EVgo, and ChargePoint.
All right.
And going back in time, I've been driving EVs for a long time now. I've had trouble with all of these but Tesla. I've never had the opportunity to use a Tesla network. But I'm hearing good things that ChargePoint is doing a lot about quality and a lot about expanding their network. And I think they're good sports being on the show.
Yes.
And I appreciate that. On the phone right now is Rob Newton, the Senior Director of Marketing at ChargePoint. Rob, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. And it's not fair to make me start laughing right before you bring me on. I was giggling to myself and had to hit mute really quick just in case you guys are going to hear me in the background. So.
I have, in fact, had bad experience with most of the charging networks, and I'm glad to hear not only that ChargePoint is doing stuff about quality, but I've also had some experiences locally, not with ChargePoint, but with a different brand, and my last three experiences have been perfect, absolutely perfect. They couldn't have gone better. And you've got lots of news about not only quality, but also expanding the network. And one of the most interesting things, if I can quote your CEO, combined with Eaton's end-to-end grid capabilities, ChargePoint is delivering solutions to help EVs win on pure economics, regardless of tax incentives or government support. Well, that's darn good news, sir.
Yeah, I think, as we look at what we're doing with Eaton, we've kind of been throwing out this 30-30-30. When you're doing these deployments, we're looking at 30% lower CapEx. So, you know, what you're going to spend up front, 30% lower operational expenses for when you've got it in the ground, and then about 30% smaller footprint. So we want to make it fit everywhere. We want to make it make sense from an affordability perspective. What was kind of just good for the planet before, we really think is going to be good for business, and we're going to be able to see a lot faster returns on investment, which hopefully needs more chargers and more places for more people.
So talk a little bit about the business. Is this a profitable market to be in right now, providing electricity at the fast DC pace?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the way that we look at this is a little bit different. So first of all, we actually aren't technically network operators ourselves. Many of our customers, what you'd call a charge point operator, right? And what we do is we enable them with the charging hardware, the software, and the services for them to be able to take full advantage of that. whether that's a business that's going to be driving, you know, bringing drivers to their place of business in order to drive more revenue, whether that's a workplace who is going to offer it as an amenity in order to get better people, you know, into their companies and ultimately, you know, have a higher quality employee so that they get a better, you know, they have a better business outcome from that respect. Or it's a fleet, right? And a fleet is a little bit different. They're thinking a lot about cost, and we're able to help them bring their total cost of ownership of their vehicles and, of course, their fueling costs way, way down. So for all those reasons, we really believe that we can actually help a lot of those folks break even on their charging very quickly, while also allowing them, you know, in the case of the retailer or the workplace, for when they're in off hours, to be able to charge for charging and make some money off the electrons that they're transferring to the vehicle as well.
Interesting. So will consumers see charge point equipment and charge point service under other brand names?
You can. So we offer our chargers to a number of different businesses, and then we also allow them to rebrand them, right? So you might go out to, say, a Love's truck stop, and you'll see a bunch of charging DC fast chargers with a Love skin on them. They'll still usually have charge point at the top, and you'll know that it is a charge point station, and it's going to carry that. But we allow folks to rebrand the chargers in order for them to, you know, because a lot of these folks want to have, you know, have it show up in an environment where their brand is very important to them, right?
Sure.
It still will carry the ChargePoint branding as well on the cables and usually at the top of the station, depending on which one we're talking about. But we don't white label them out to other brands. The only partnership that we have where there's something similar to that is that many of our chargers will now carry the ChargePoint powered by Eaton moniker. And that's because we are creating a joint solution with Eaton where they're providing the power distribution equipment and we are providing the chargers. And it's all sort of part of one big package.
You know, I think what you've done in this space since 2007 has got to be difficult. And I think what most people don't realize is how hard it is to start something that is brand new, like an EV charging network. But when they get to a charger that isn't working, they're not thinking about that. They're not giving you any grace whatsoever. They're just knowing that they need to get their vehicle charged. And they're mad that it doesn't work. What would you say are some of the top reasons why, just so people understand how difficult this is or what the issues are, what are some of the top reasons why a charger might not work when you want it to work?
Yeah, no, there's a ton, right? But I think number one is bad install. And I think, you know, you can test these things as much as you want when you build them in the factory. But if you don't put them in the ground right, whether you set them up with the wrong type of power set capabilities, whether you haven't, you know, done a good job on the make ready, there's just a whole bunch of things that can go wrong. So a few things we've done there, we actually offer our own deployment services so we can go out and work with our partners in order to get those put in the ground the right way. We also have created a training and certification program for all those partners so that you have to train on general EV charging install. And then also for each one of the stations that we offer, you can train on that specifically so that you're certified to install that particular station. So again, we want to make sure that we're empowering the industry to actually do this right and to make sure that those chargers go into the ground effectively. The other big thing that we're seeing out there is vandalism, right? Like so many of these things you put in a deployment, and then 2 weeks later, all the cables are cut.
I've seen two things
for that. One, yeah, it's crazy.
It's terrible.
The cables as they are today, most of them, you get a decent bolt cutter, it's just, you can take out 10, 15 in a minute. It's really bad. So what we did was we created a cut-resistant cable. It's resistant. It's not going to prevent the cut. In fact, that particular one, once it's got a little cut, it's not usable anymore. But it's going to take you, instead of 1 second, it's going to take you 15, 20, 30 seconds. And then on top of that, we built something called ChargePoint Protect, which is taking the heat sensor in that cable, and once it detects that something's trying to cut through it, an alarm goes off, not just on that station, but on all the stations around it that you deem you want to have that alarm go off. It'll tell them, hey, that the owner of this station and the authorities have been notified. And so, you know, you can imagine instead of just walking up, having nobody notice that you're cutting 10, 15 cables, all of a sudden now you're trying to get through one, you're struggling, all of a sudden the alarm's going off, the noise is going off, the lights are going off. So we hope that that's going to offer a really strong deterrent that, yeah, you'll lose one cable, but you're not going to lose 15 on your whole site and take the whole thing out. So those are just a couple of the things we're working on in order to really increase the reliability and ultimately the durability of these stations.
Rob, in terms of quality or reliability, do you have any numbers that sort of express how things have gotten better in, say, the last 5 years or even just the last 2 years?
I don't have great hard numbers. What I can tell you is that we used to have, you know, so many issues that it was hard for us even to respond on some of these things. But now we do offer a number of different support services that allow for you to be able to take care of these things with a lot greater certainty. So, for example, our Assure service offers, 24-hour, or sorry, our Assure Pro service offers 24-hour resolution times, and then, you know, a 90% uptime guarantee. So that's really, really helpful in sort of, you know, assuring that there is some reliability to those. And then on top of that, we've also created this new service called Safeguard Care, which is just a group of people that come out and check on your stations, right? So we've got a ton of stuff in the background. You know, we've got a network operations center that's tracking a lot of things, and we didn't have this in the past. It can track almost everything at the, I'll call it digital level, that might be going wrong with your station, so that that we can not only repair, like roll a truck out to those stations when we see it, even proactively, we can tell that something's about to happen, and we can go ahead and take care of that. And then we can also, excuse me, now we've got people that are coming out to the station so that anything that they don't pick up digitally, we're able to actually see. So you can see a cut cable, a broken lens, a broken latch, and those things can also be, you know, seen every, you know, couple of weeks or every month, depending on your plan, so that we've got people out there. So I'd say that while I don't have hard numbers, we have a lot of different use cases that we've started to account for to make sure that no matter what is actually going wrong with your station, we're able to address it quickly and proactively and then get those stations back up and running fast.
So why is charging an EV hard? You get the sense, I think, if you're a regular consumer, you want to buy an EV, you think it should be as easy as plugging your car in. Like, how complicated can that be? You know, you plug your TV in and that works. So what is it about charging an electric car that is actually complicated and actually causes these issues that result in unhappy customers?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is that the standards are different, right? So a lot of people will show up to a station. Maybe they just show up to a station that's nearby. They didn't use an app to sort of find one that's compatible with their vehicle.
That's what
they'll
I do.
Look at it. Yeah, exactly. And you might find that the standard on that one is different and that you got to drive around a little bit to find one. So one thing that we created is something called Omniport. And Omniport carries both the J1772 standard, which was the sort of original standard in North America, and then the NACS cable as well, which was, you know, for lack of a better way to describe it was a long time known as the Tesla charger.
Right.
And now many other OEMs are starting to adopt the NACS standard, but what we don't want the station owner to have to be sort of prognosticating on who's going to adopt what and when. They shouldn't be doing that. They run a business that does something completely different. So with this, they don't have to guess anymore. They put this in. And, you know, we still offer CHAdeMO cables as well, but basically almost every vehicle on the road now is one of those two standards. So every port is going to be able to charge almost every vehicle on the road. That also makes it super easy for drivers. They just pull up. If they have it in their phone and they tap their phone on it to charge, it's automatically going to deploy the right one. But they also on the station can choose which one is right for them. I think that that's going to take away from a lot of that confusion and a lot of that difficulty being able to find a place to charge. Because ultimately, it's just about port availability. I mean, even when we talk about reliability, we really are talking about, like, if I pull up to this thing, is it going to work?
Right.
Is it going to work for my car? And so between the reliability things that we talked about earlier and also the stuff that we're doing with things like Omniport to make it, you know, every port can charge every vehicle, I think we're going to make it a lot simpler for folks. But, you know, acknowledging it's hard. And I think that, you know, people are sort of moving into a world where it's not like a gas station where you can just pull up. Sometimes you might need to do a little bit more on the front end to make sure that you're going to be able to find the charge lead.
So talking about charge points specifically now, does it make sense then if you own an EV to sign up with you guys and have a charge point account? Or is it just the same experience if you just flash your credit card?
Yeah, I think it does make sense. Within the ChargePoint app, you're able to find over a million charging stations between, you know, the ones that are ChargePoint stations and about 860,000 that are on our roaming partner networks. So there's over a million places to charge across North America that you're able to find. I think when you use that, you're also able to see, you know, as I said, sort of what type of charger it is, what the charging standard that they're using on every charger is. You can actually enter in your vehicle, and then it will just show you chargers that are going to work with your vehicle, so you don't have to deal with kind of the guesswork of trying to figure out whether this one's going to work or that one's going to work.
That's handy.
And we've got a lot of really cool stuff coming. So in the very near future, we're going to have a lot of enhancements to the app that we're looking forward to sharing. It's going to be, you know, things that essentially make it more of an experience as opposed to just being able to find a place to charge.
And having a ChargePoint account, does that affect the price you pay? Do you get a discount for membership?
So having a ChargePoint account does make the service fee reduced. The other thing is, you know, if you're charging at a workplace, for example, mm-hmm. that account is going to be part of your credential that can potentially put you in a group that charges for free, right? So if one of our larger customers who has, you know, 1,000 chargers in their parking lots across their large campus has set up a group for the workplace customer, they will then be able to charge on those chargers for free. Whereas if you and I went to visit that office, we would then have to, we most likely would have to pay a certain fee in order to be able to charge at those chargers.
I gotcha. I wanted to go back to the press release a little bit that you guys shared about Eaton, your cooperative effort with Eaton. And one of the most interesting things in there to me was the capability to deliver up to 600 kilowatts of power, which sounds a little futuristic and gee whiz, because right now I think the fastest networks out there are about 350 watts. And we keep hearing about cars coming out of China, you know, that can charge in 3 minutes and all that. But 600 watts is getting you pretty close to, I think, the same time it takes to fill your car with gas. How realistic is that? Because right now, I don't think there are that many vehicles on the road that can accept power that quickly. But do you see those coming down the pike? And how soon will you get those chargers out there?
You're absolutely right in that it's a relationship between what the vehicle can accept and what the charger can output. And we are seeing vehicles doing this. So we just actually had a Lucid Gravity come over to the headquarters to charge, and we were able to get it up to 400 kilowatt output, which is awesome. And that was actually on our existing platform. Yeah, it was really fast. We were really, really excited. Now, Lucid, obviously, very high end vehicle. It is quote unquote a futuristic vehicle, right? But we are seeing these come out. The other thing I'll say is, like, you know, charging deployments take time, right? So when we announce a charger that's going to be able to do that, you know, once we start selling that charger, it's still going to take a while for those deployments to happen because it's part of new construction, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got to be ahead of the vehicle with the capabilities that we can do as a charger. And I think, you know, when in a year's time, when you start seeing those come out, you're probably going to see the first few vehicles be able to actually charge close to that, or, you know, 500, 600 kilowatts. So I think it will become more prevalent as those chargers are out there. You know, we also want to keep in mind, like, the chargers need to be ahead of the curve because they're going to stay on the ground for 10 years or more while the vehicles continue to grow and sort of evolve. So again, we want the chargers to be, you know, slightly ahead of the curve in terms of charging capability. And then when the vehicles are ready for it, we're going to be ready for that.
Rob, we've run out of time, but where can people find out more about ChargePoint and ChargePoint chargers?
Check us out at chargepoint.com. You can find all of our different charging capabilities there. We're, you know, super excited to continue to deploy more and to continue to build out this great thing that I think is now just as good for business as it is for the planet.
Yeah, it is great stuff. Thank you for sharing today. That was Rob Newton with ChargePoint. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, quiz time.
It's quiz time.
Quiz time.
Questions or comments?
Drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.
That's carstuff@consumerguide.com.
Hi, it's Brendan from Sons of Speed. You've heard me and my colleague Paul on the Car Stuff podcast whenever Jill's out of town. But now you can hear us every week on the We Are Motor Driven podcast, along with Jennifer from Auto Exotica and Harvey from Rides and Drives. We talk about everything from sports cars to trucks to EVs and our favorite, speed. So join us each week by searching We Are Motor Driven wherever you get your favorite podcast.
Welcome back to the Car Stuff Podcast.
All right, we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I am Tom. He is Brendan. We've been talking a lot about EVs today.
Yes, and we know what we forgot to talk about.
What's that?
Your prodigious online presence.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I am Car Guy Tom.
And
that's on Twitter X and on Blue Sky. I'm really far behind again on my car spotters from the weekend, but I will get those up. Hashtag Car Spotter.
You know, I just put up a Car Spotter on our...
What'd you find?
Well, it's kind of a mystery. I know what it is, but I want everyone else to go guess. So if you go to our Twitter is Sons of Speed on X, I keep calling it Twitter, you will see a covered vehicle that I found in Houston that it's pretty cool.
I was hoping it was a Daewoo or an Isuzu.
No.
I'm pretty good at those.
It's a little cooler than those.
If you want to have a skill that pays no money and never will, it's being able to identify Daewoos and Isuzus at a distance.
Do you remember the days when we could identify vehicles by their headlights at night?
I have talked to my buddy Dave about this a lot. we could drive around at night on the highway, and based on taillight signature or headlight signature,
yes,
we knew what they were.
Exactly, and that's how you knew the cops when the cops were coming.
Yeah, especially the back Caprices. when it was the Diplomat and the Grand Fury were most of the cop cars. They were really easy to identify.
I'm a little younger, so when I was driving, it was the Caprice Classics, and I could nail them from a long ways away.
Those were easy.
Yeah.
Unless someone messed with you, and it was the rare Pontiac.
Right.
Which was very similar, actually.
Speaking of Pontiac, I heard last week's quiz, Jill, you did very well. I'm surprised.
Yeah.
But because, you know, it was
Pontiac.
It was older cars, you know, which is typically not her strong suit.
How can people follow you guys?
Yes, so we are at on Facebook. We're Sons of Speed, Redline Your Soul. You can find us there. We are Motor Driven everywhere online as well, including Instagram. And I don't think we are Motor Driven's on it's not on TikTok, and it's not on Twitter. So there, in those two places, just search Sons of Speed, and you'll find us.
There you go. Yeah, I know you guys are on Twitter, X.
Or just go to our website, wearemotordriven.com, and all the links are there.
There you go. All right, are you ready for a quiz?
I am.
You haven't done a quiz in a long time.
I know. Let's hope it goes well.
I came up with one that I thought would be a little obscure.
Okay.
But kind of up your alley.
Okay.
The quiz today's the quiz topic is, did it have a V8?
Oh, I like it.
All right. I've got five cars right here. You just have to tell me if there was ever a V8 installed in that vehicle.
You can't see me perking up at the mention of V8s, but I did.
All right, number one, the Toyota 4Runner.
Ooh. Well, the 4Runner has had a smooth V6 forever and ever.
A big, smooth, torquey lump.
Yeah.
Low horsepower, lots of torque.
And they just got rid of it in this latest iteration. I don't think it ever got a V8. I would say no.
It did.
Oh, no. You're kidding.
And I completely forgot about this. But between 2003 and 2009, the 4Runner was available with a 235 horsepower, 4.7 liter V8.
I was going to say it's a 4.6, 7, 8.
Yeah, because that 4.7 was available in the Tundra for a while, too.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's a weird one.
Well, good on Toyota, bad on me. I'm sorry.
All right. Very similar vehicle. The Nissan Pathfinder. Was the Nissan Pathfinder ever equipped with a V8 engine?
Wow. Again, Pathfinders.
It's a vehicle that's moving four-cylinder.
Well, the Armada always had the V8. Boy, that is a tough one. The Pathfinder ever have a V8? I don't think it did. Please don't tell me it did.
It also did.
Oh, God.
This one I sort of remember.
Japanese brands are killing me.
We talked about the V8 that used to be in the Armada. Same V8, the 5.6 liter V8 between 2008 and 2012. I'm not sure what years in that range it had it, but that generation of the vehicle.
Those are not that big of vehicles that have V8s in them. So
no, and I don't know why they thought they needed to do that. But you know what? If you go back that far, Ford was cramming V8s in the Explorer.
Jeep was putting them in the Grand Cherokee.
Yeah, and yeah. Chevy was cramming them in the Trailblazer, GMC and the Envoy.
And this is why Tom is the test guru, because he comes up with the vehicles that, like, even if you know this stuff, you don't know this stuff.
Yeah, well, you forget it.
Yeah.
The Buick Rainier, for example, was available with a V8.
Oh, no. Wow.
No one remembers the Rainier.
No. No. Much less that it had a V8.
It's actually a nice car.
So I need, like, you know, three out of the next five questions. Well, there's six questions total with the bonus. Yep. I need three to get
five
win.
Questions total.
I'm down
2-0
now.
Yep. All right. The Buick Lucerne.
Oh. Gosh, I don't remember what the Lucerne looks like.
My dad owned a Lucerne. Served him well.
Is this a sedan?
It was. It was sort of that.
All the brands that I don't pay attention to, Buick, Nissan. I mean, I do pay attention to Toyota, I should
say. The base
say.
Engine in the Lucerne, if I'm correct, was a Chevy 3.9 liter V6.
Well, did it ever have the revs. Iron, the not the Iron Duke, but the 3800, that honey of a 6?
Lucerne never did.
Okay.
The previous Buick did. What am I thinking of?
Park Avenue had it. The Le Sabre.
Yeah.
That was a great engine. Oh, the Lucerne doesn't. Did Buick even have a V8 after they jettisoned them in the 70s? Jeez. All right. You got to have a no in there somewhere, so I'm going to say no.
It did.
Oh, you can't have three yeses. That's not fair. In a row?
Yeah, it was the 4.6 liter Northstar V8. And since they were cramming that
in. They put the Northstar in a Buick?
Only because basically, technically, that vehicle was the same as the Bonneville and the Cadillac DTS. So as long as they were cramming V8s into the other ones, it was they knew it was going to fit here.
You got to maximize your investment dollars, I guess.
I guess. You need to get the next three, sir.
Oh, boy. Hey.
The Oldsmobile Trofeo.
It's me rolling my eyes.
The Trofeo was such an interesting car because it was really a dutied up wasn't that Toronado.
Yeah, exactly. It was the size of a Toronado.
Yeah, and it was basically a Toronado.
I remember the Toronado was a really nice vehicle back for the in its day.
I love the Toronado.
Yeah.
Especially the first generation. And then that really boxy generation that kicked in around 79.
Did the Trofeo have that, like, abbreviated trunk?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's kind of gangly. It was weird looking.
It was a bit weird looking, but in an affectionate way, almost.
Mechanically, it was related to the Buick Riata.
Okay.
And a lot of people think that was a beautiful car. And to me, it's like, yeah, it's a little weird looking.
Yeah, yeah.
A little misshapen.
That thing was not well put together. Well, if it's related to the Riata.
I've heard that.
Never had a V8. I'm going to say no.
It did not, no.
Okay, finally we get to a no. Fourth question.
Only powered by the Buick 3800.
There you go.
Ever. And not even the fun supercharged version.
But still that engine will last forever.
All right, you probably know this one off the bat. The Plymouth Prowler.
No. And it should have. See, this is the question I was thinking I was going to get number one.
There was a Plymouth concept car. And I forgot what it was called, but it was based on the Prowler, stuffed full of V8 goodness. I forgot what that was called.
Was it the Venom?
I don't know.
The Venom was like the baby Viper, and they did put a 5.2 in there, and it was a concept, and they should have built it because people would have bought it, and they just didn't for some reason. And that was the one concept that from the 90s that Lutz should have built. And
So
I'm going to miss on that one.
Plymouth Prowler, crazy little roadster, sold by Plymouth for 1 year before Plymouth went out of business.
Yes, and then became the Chrysler Prowler.
Yeah, I didn't realize they skipped a year. I learned this today.
Oh.
So 1997 Prowler, 1999 through 2002, it was Chrysler Prowler.
Which doesn't have the same alliteration, does it?
No. And then it was powered by a 3.5-liter V6 that was only 214 horsepower.
And stuck with a 5-speed auto-stick automatic.
Yeah.
Well.
When it became a Chrysler, it did pick up a lot of horsepower, though. It went to 253. All right, you need to get the bonus question.
Wow, it matters this time. Here we go.
It does, yeah. Chex Mix.
Okay. I love Chex Mix.
And I don't know if my mom ever made Chex Mix, but you've been able to buy it since 1987.
As a mix. Yeah.
Yep, you could just buy it that way. And it was just their way of selling, like, all four versions. Is it rice, corn, wheat?
Yeah, what was the other one?
I don't know. Semolina? I have no idea. Oat.
Which I learned what that is, actually.
Semolina?
Yeah, it makes pasta.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's what they used to make, like, pasta in Italy, because I took an Italian pasta class in Tuscany.
Oh, I was lucky I knew the word.
Yeah, I didn't know what the word was. So we all learned something new.
Because I've got nothing to do, I was at the Chex Mix website today. And I've got four different varieties of Chex Mix here. You have to tell me which one is the fake.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I am ready.
Identify the fake Chex Mix.
All righty.
Because we're adults, this is what we do with our time. Spicy dill.
Okay.
Strawberry cream. Bavarian bratwurst. Cheesy pizza.
The only one that sounds off. What was the second one?
Strawberry cream. With an accent over the E.
Like... Chex Mix is not supposed to be sweet. That is a savory type, you know. They never put candy in it, at least that I know of. It always had the pretzels and the mustard powder and the onion powder. And,
yeah.
You know, they had that. So, okay, one more time. I think I have my choice, but let's see.
Spicy dill.
Sounds about right.
Strawberry creme, cream. Bavarian bratwurst, cheesy pizza.
Yeah, so the last two sound exactly... correct. The first one was
spicy dill,
which also same flavor category. So I'm going to say the strawberry is the fake.
It is not.
Oh, my.
Nope. The bratwurst is the fake.
Womp, womp, womp.
Yeah.
They didn't make an Oktoberfest bratwurst.
They did not. There was a time when, I think their primary outlet is 7-Eleven.
Uh-huh.
And I used to walk into 7-Elevens a lot for Diet Pepsi.
Yes, you did.
And if I found a new variety of Chex Mix, my daughter and I would sample those. But there's like extreme flavors. There's bold, and there is another sweet one.
Is there?
What is it? What is that chocolate marshmallow thing. Is it like Muddy Buddies
s'mores?
Or something?
S'mores?
It's like a s'mores thing.
Okay.
It's not called s'mores.
Yeah.
But it's good. But it is sweet.
That's something from my childhood that I would never associate with sweetness. So, unfortunately, yes, I have lost the quiz. I apologize. I let everybody down.
You know, the thing about Chex and Chex Mix, when I was a kid and I'd be having breakfast, and it would usually be like rice Chex or wheat Chex,
mm-hmm.
not that exciting, but I'd be reading the box.
Yes.
I'd be reading the box, and there was always a recipe for Chex Mix on the side of the box.
There was.
And my mother never made it.
No, they never made it like that. They
no.
just make their own recipe. This is what we did before we had phones, children, is we used to read cereal boxes while eating.
Or the thing about that is you'd have a whole box of cereal, five or six or seven breakfasts lined up,
yep.
and then there'd be a maze sometimes on the back of the cereal
oh,
box,
yes.
which you did once.
Uh-huh.
And it was too easy.
Well, and if you wanted to cheat at the maze, it was really easy. You just started at the exit and then forked your way to the beginning.
Yeah, so the maze wasn't good. The games on the box weren't good. You needed stuff to read.
Yes.
Yeah, and the ingredients weren't that interesting.
No.
So.
Although now they're getting longer and longer. It'd probably take you an entire time to eat a bowl of cereal to read the ingredients on a bowl of cereal.
All right, I got this here for you. I drove here today.
In a taxi cab.
It looks like a taxi cab.
It what does look like a taxi cab.
I didn't get the name of that color yet, but I'm in the new Prius. I've always been a fan of the Prius, and now the Prius looks good, which is weird. I do question the Prius's position in the Toyota lineup, because Toyota's a hybrid everything.
Right.
And the Camry is all hybrid. The Corolla's available as a hybrid. And those vehicles rival this vehicle for space and efficiency. So I'm not 100% sure. And I don't get it from their marketing, what this vehicle is supposed to be.
Is it the virtue signal vehicle now still?
I don't know. Maybe it is still that. Maybe there's still people who just want people to know that they're doing it. It's very good looking now.
And I've talked about this before, that from the front bumper to the top of the windshield is about the same break as you get like in a Lamborghini Countach. It's one angle.
Yeah. And so
it looks good.
Clearly super aerodynamic.
Yeah. And you can get the solar panel roof charger, which never worked for me when I had it in the dead of winter, but maybe it works in the summertime better. But yes, yours does. It's this obnoxious yellow color that looks like a taxi cab. If they don't call it obnoxious yellow, they should.
It's so funny because when my daughter was looking for a car, she wanted a different color.
Mm-hmm.
Like she didn't want a common color.
Oh, okay.
And the color she got was different-ish.
Okay.
It's nice. It's kind of a nice clay kind of thing. It's a good looking color, but it doesn't quite stick out.
No, she probably wanted a lime or a yellow.
She did.
Or an orange. Yeah.
She did. And when we were test driving, she drove an Nissan Kicks that was yellow. Like she wanted that, but she didn't like the Kicks.
You know, life is too boring to always have the same color car.
It is.
And sometimes you got to put a little spice in your life.
Years ago, I interviewed a dealer about ordering cars and why cars are the colors they are, and for the exact reasons we think.
Yep.
It's simply that dealers don't want stuff on the lot that are going to take time to get rid of.
So there's a very famous story from the 70s, early 70s, and it's speaking of just cars that are hard to get rid of. And we think back now to like 1970, and you're like, oh, if I could go back, the cars I would buy and the colors I would buy them in, right? There was a dealer had a 70 Superbird. It was either a Superbird or it was a 69 Charger Daytona.
Those were famously difficult to sell anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it had this huge wing on the back, 6 feet tall. They had the nose cone.
That's most of the reason it was difficult to sell.
Right. And now they're worth $1 million.
Yep.
But back then, they had to sportify this thing. They had to take the spoiler off and take the nose cone off and put the regular Charger Plymouth, what was that, based off the Satellite or the Roadrunner, and make it basically into that and change the color from the bright green that it was to some, you know, pedestrian color just so they could sell it. And you know, that's the kind of thing. Like at the time, nobody wanted that car in a bold color. And now that thing rolls across, you know, an auction line at Mecum and it'll fetch $1 million if it's a heavy. And
yeah, it's funny.
It's crazy.
When I sold cars in 1991, I sold Fords.
Okay.
And this was when the Explorer had just come out.
Yes, big seller.
And if you couldn't sell an Explorer, that was on you.
Yeah.
Demand was huge.
It was.
Huge, huge, huge. And we somehow managed to get, and I'm sure the owner of the dealership I was working for didn't order this thing, we had the unsellable Explorer.
Oh.
And it was a two-door, rear-drive, crystal blue Eddie Bauer. Like, everything about this thing was wrong. Eddie Bauer was popular.
I thought the Eddie Bauers were all green with
green
the
or red.
Interior.
Yeah.
Oh, they had a red too. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know where this crystal blue came from, but it had Eddie Bauer trim. It also didn't have the bigger wheels. Like, everyone got the bigger wheels. So this thing was just unsellable. Oh, and it was stick. I'm sorry. It was stick.
Oh, I would have liked it.
But, we couldn't give that thing away. It was the only Explorer that we couldn't sell.
Wow.
People just wanted Explorers so badly. And we sold an awful lot of green Eddie Bauers and XLTs.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Like crazy.
That was such an ubiquitous car back then. And the, Paul's brother, Anthony, had a 91 Probe in that nice, dark, deep blue. It was with a gray interior. I remember second generation Probe, really nice vehicle.
Slick car.
Yeah, basically a Mazda underneath, so it drove really well.
There was a version of that car, and we're running out of time here, but the Probe could be had in LX trim as a mid-trim level with a Ford V6.
Yeah.
Just the 3-liter V6. Yeah. And you could get that with stick, and it was kind of smooth. And that turbocharged engine was a little edgy.
Yeah, and Paul's brother had the V6 with the stick. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was
nice. Yeah, it was kind of smooth. I liked that car a lot. Thought about buying one, but I never did.
I did like that vehicle.
All right. Guess what we did, sir?
We had a great show today.
We did. Thank you so much for jumping in and filling in.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Big thanks to Rob Newton of ChargePoint for joining us today. Thank you to Brendan. Thank you to my friend Stephen Johnny for having me on the show this past weekend. Big thanks to producer Randy and the good folks here at TalkZone. Let's talk more about cars again.
Next week.
Remember to check us out at consumerguide.com.
The Car Stuff Podcast is produced by J-Turn Media.
To advertise on the show, please drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.